This is Peter Ford. I was ambassador to Syria between 2003 and 2006. After that, I continued to visit Syria regularly when I was working for United Nations for a further 8 years. More recently, I've been active within the Workers' Party of Britain, led by George Galloway. I'm now one of the deputy leaders of that party.
As someone that's done a bit of Foreign Office and a bit of UN, Peter, can you be brutally honest about the effectiveness of the United Nations these days?
Well, the UN has many organisations under its umbrella, some more effective than others. The Security Council still has an important role to play, not least because of the power of veto wielded by Russia and America and ourselves, and China and France. If it wasn't there, it would have to be reinvented. As a former UN employee, I'm slightly prejudiced in its favour, but I have to admit that in recent years it's looked more and more irrelevant, but that is not through the fault of the UN itself, but because of the behaviour mainly of the great superpower, the United States, which has ignored the UN when it suited the United States and used it as a tool, weaponized it when that was possible and useful to America.
Are there some reforms that you, as someone now on the outside, would like to see?
Over the long term, the UN, including the Security Council, will have to adjust to the changing power balance between the imperial north and the global south. The organizations like the BRICS, the rise of China and India, sooner or later, these tectonic shifts in the geopolitical balance will have to be recognized in the power sharing within the United Nations, but it will take generations, I'm afraid.
This week we've seen extraordinary developments in Syria, the country for which you were the British ambassador. Can you take us through what's happened? I know at least two major cities in central and northern Syria have been actually been seized by what the BBC calls rebels.
Yes, well, essentially, the Syrian Taliban are off the reservation. The Syrian Taliban had been nurtured for several years in the last redoubt of Idlib province up on the northern border with Turkey. And over the years, they have been reinforced, replenished, funded, helped by Turkey primarily with equipment and training, by Qatar, our new besties in the Gulf, the Emir of Qatar here hobnobbing this week, funded these jihadis, the Syrian Taliban, by Qatar, their salaries paid by Qatar, and also receiving technical assistance and training from Ukraine, who are always up to do anything that would spike Russian guns. Also, there has been covert support from Western countries, including our own, even though the lead organization in Idlib, Hayat Tahrir al-Shams, HTS, the Organization for the Liberation of Syria, as it calls itself, even though HTS is an organization proscribed as a terrorist organization by the United Nations and by the United States, but strangely not by the UK. I think someone ought to ask our ministers about that one. Anyway, this bunch of Syrian Taliban suddenly broke off the reservation, taking advantage of a moment of weakness in the Syrian army. So it's not just been a moment. The Syrian army has been weakened over the last several years. The culmination of years of Western sanctions on Syria, which have decimated the Syrian economy and made it virtually impossible for the Syrian government to maintain a standing army. Syria is a very poor and impoverished country, largely as a result of our sanctions. We, therefore, have created the conditions for a weakening of the Syrian armed forces and this breakout by the Syrian Taliban. It's been lightning fast. The Syrian Taliban have made more gains in 6 days than the Syrian army was able to make in the opposite direction over 6 years. And it will take more than 6 days to push them back. They're now on the southern outskirts of Hama city, threatening to move south 20, 30 miles or so to the next town, going south in the direction of Damascus, Homs, which has been, during the course of the Syrian conflict, another stronghold of the jihadis. So things are not looking good for the Syrian government and its allies.
Well, no. What about the British attitude? You did hint at it there. What's the, not proscribing this terror organisation? It does seem that we are here in the Foreign Office. We're quite particular about who gets called terrorists and who doesn't. Even parts of the Iranian army are described as terrorist organisations, and yet not these so-called rebels.
Well, it's quite astonishing that this organisation, HTF, has not been proscribed by the UK. And I was reading a debate that took place in Parliament just 3 days ago, in which the noble lords betrayed such an ignorance of the situation that they assumed that it was a proscribed organisation by the UK, and the minister on duty didn't contradict that. Maybe didn't even know himself. But I think we need clarity on this point. Why are these Syrian Taliban not proscribed by the UK? Even the Americans, for heaven's sake, don't fancy these people. Why do we? But more broadly, we need to realize that this is the culmination of our policy, Western policy, that we enthusiastically adopted to cut the Syrian army off at the knees. That has been our declared policy with sanctions and every other weapon that we've been able to deploy, including propaganda, to render the Syrian army incapable of resisting a new uprising. That is what we wanted. That is what the sanctions were for. And that is what is happening now. So all the bloodshed and the massacres and the beheadings are partly down to us. I think this should be accepted for what it is. We wanted this, and now we've got the Syrian Taliban rampaging over the country, opening prisons today videos of prisoners being let out of Hama prison, including ISIS. Huh? Think about that. And many more to come. Thousands of ISIS operatives are now on the loose in Syria. They were caged by the Syrian government, or regime, as the British government likes to call it. They were being caged by Assad. Now they've been let out by our friends. So let's wait for the backwash from that, and let's wait for the backwash also from the waves, the new waves of migration, refugees, terrified minorities from the Christians, the Alawites, the Druze, the Kurds, Armenians, all the secular Sunnis who don't go along with extremist, militant Islam. All these people will be fleeing if they can avoid the massacres which will now be taking place. We must take responsibility for this and be ready for more of this lapping up on our shores.
Can you just give us an idea of the sort of demographics of the rebels in Syria? I mean, it seems obvious that there's there was a civil war brewed up in the early 2010s, and that there's some sort of genuine grievances that the people in Syria had. But what about what is it they really find impossible to get on with about Bashar al-Assad, the president? Is it a religious thing? Are there differences between, different sects? These are obviously extremist Islamists. But what's the demographics here? What is going on the ground, in people's different beliefs that has set them completely against Assad?
These are all virtually without exception people who belong to the Sunni part of Islam. And their quest is for Sunni supremacy. They can't bear that the president of Syria should not be a Sunni. They can't bear the tolerance shown by the Syrian government over a country which is a mosaic of religions and communities. They cannot bear that. Essentially, what you have are Syrian Taliban. It's that simple. Think of the Afghan Taliban and the forces of secularism that were pitted against them. And it's very similar in Syria. There are the forces of secularism, which includes, by the way, women's rights. What is happening in Syria right now is a huge setback for women's rights, about which normally we care so very, very much. Not a word right now in the liberal press, in your Guardian, on your BBC. No, because above all, they are against Assad, because the British government is against Assad, who has committed the mortal sin of accepting help from Russia and Iran, so that Syria could remain a secular, tolerant state, not bullied like other Arab countries into becoming part of the American Empire.
We've had 14 months in Israel now, and the occupied West Bank, Gaza, and southern Lebanon it's been called by Amnesty this week genocide in Gaza, particularly. And also there have been confrontations between Syria and Israel as part of that. So what's been going on, and do you think that this is related?
It's a ricochet off the Gaza-Lebanon conflict. The Israelis, when they invaded Lebanon, were explicitly intending to trigger or to reignite the Lebanese civil war, to create hostility by Lebanese against Hezbollah and to weaken Hezbollah and create the conditions for a new civil war in Lebanon. But without quite planning it, the Israelis have managed to reignite the civil war next door in Syria by weakening Hezbollah, which was one of the linchpins of stability in Syria. By weakening Hezbollah and forcing it to concentrate on its backyard in Lebanon and pull forces back from Syria, the Israelis, supported, of course, by ourselves in this, have managed to create the conditions for the Syrian Taliban to come down off the reservation.
Is there any evidence the Israelis support what you call the Syrian Taliban? What used to be called, actually, weren't they, Al-Nusra Front? And now I find it unbelievable, in a way, that they are called Al-Sham, because, I mean, it's almost as if this organisation is a sham. But, I mean, is there evidence that they are receiving material support from the Israelis, intelligence support, that sort of thing?
Well, this has been openly admitted by retired senior Israeli generals. Just recently, one of the top generals admitted that they'd sent supplies, and not just humanitarian or medical supplies, but military supplies, to Syrian jihadis. More recently, Israel has been stepping up its already very numerous bombing attacks on sites in Syria, thought to be used by Hezbollah. Just about 10 days ago, the Israelis killed about 60 people in one of their bombing raids on Syria, and it's almost as though it was concerted with the jihadis. And now, breaking news today, I read statements from the Israeli leadership that they're going to step up their bombing of Syria to prevent Iran and Hezbollah coming to the rescue. So they are absolutely in league with the Syrian Taliban, and the Syrian Taliban with our de facto allies, enthusiastic allies, in fact, of the Israelis. These same jihadis have never so much as broken a window in Israel, never lifted a finger, even in their rhetoric. They make almost nothing of Syria, the odd mention of Jerusalem apart. But they are helped by Israel and de facto surrogates of the Israelis.
Now, 150 years ago, there was something called the Crimean War. I mean, that was the British. I didn't realise until recently, Peter, there was 500,000 deaths in the Crimean War. Absolutely amazing, really, to think that the British would bother to go and attack Crimea in the Black Sea. But this is, of course, an important base for the Russians, and still is. And in Syria, there is another important Eastern Mediterranean base for at Tartus for the Russian fleet. Now, as Al-Sham pushes its way, Al-Nusra, whatever we want to call them, southwards from Hama towards Homs, that is actually cutting off Tartars, the part of the Mediterranean coast of Syria, from the rest of the country. And I wonder whether the Russians are looking at this and saying, hang on a minute, we need that naval base if we're going to project any power into the Eastern Mediterranean.
Well, certainly the Russians must be deeply worried, but what they can do is limited. There are limits to what air power can do, and the technology has changed in recent years, with the jihadis now having air power of their own in the shape of drones, on which they've received copious help from the Ukrainians. I would guess that the jihadis are going to leave those Russian bases alone, Tartus, the naval base, and Al-Khameimim, the air base nearby. They will leave those alone. For one thing, they don't need them in their sweep south. And for another, their Turkish maskers would not, I think, be pleased by any frontal attack on Russian assets. But it does make life more awkward for the Russians, as well, of course, for the Syrian government, which is less able to mobilize that Russian and Iranian help. There's another air base that will shortly be coming under fire called T-4, which is near Homs, and which is primarily a base for the Iranians and much used to replenish Hezbollah. That will be a major target, I suspect, for the jihadis.
Now I mentioned a little bit about the history there, but the Qataris are in London this week, the Emir of Qatar, meeting with King Charles. Qatar has played a very important role in the negotiations over Gaza and the hostage releases, this sort of thing. It's also got another very important role with the Al Jazeera, and also funding quite a lot of English language media. So what do you make of the visit? What's Qatar? I mean, first of all, I suppose, what is if you were a fly on the wall, what would you expect to be hearing up at Windsor Castle or wherever he's hanging out with the king? And what do you think is at stake with Qatar coming to the UK?
Well, from day one of the Syrian conflict, the Qataris have been helping the jihadis with propaganda, partly through Al Jazeera, which has been a constant mouthpiece for the jihadis and still is very much today. They've used their great wealth to prop up the jihadis and to keep them on life support up there in Idlib province. This is partly because of the way Qatar sees itself as it wants to make itself the indispensable link, the Gulf power that has friends in every camp and can play both ends against the middle. So they're friends of Hamas, but at the same time, they're friends of Israel. They were the first Gulf country to welcome an Israeli diplomatic office. It's also one in the eye for their great enemies, the Saudis, if Qatar can play a major role. And that's one of the reasons why they have been supportive of Hamas, because Saudi did not support Hamas. In fact, was very much against Hamas. We're supping with some very dubious characters here, the Qataris. They bear a heavy responsibility for the bloodshed in Syria, which has happened over the years, and now for helping to foment this breakout from the reservation. They must take a share of the responsibility now for the unleashing of the ISIS prisoners, which will be part of the next chapter.
And what about Turkey? Because, of course, the British kicked the Ottoman Empire out in the First World War of this whole area Syria, of Lebanon, of what's now Israel, and Turkey, I'm sure, quite sure, is playing a role in Syria. What do you think the Turks actually are looking back at history and saying, hang on, that's ours, we want it?
The Turks, I believe, want to apply the Cyprus model specifically to Syria, specifically the north. Cyprus. Turkey, as you may recall, invaded Cyprus in 1974 and set about partitioning Cyprus. So there's now a northern sliver, about 30% of Cyprus. It's de facto a Turkish colony. And this situation has lasted for 50 years. That's what they want to do in northern Syria, I believe. Partly because of their perennial concern with the Kurds, who in the past used Syria as a launch pad for needling Turkey. And more recent years, the Turks have had a problem for the millions, over 3 million Syrian refugees who fled to Turkey and who are now a huge domestic problem. We think we have problems over migration. It's nothing compared to the problem Erdogan has. So he is desperate to tip those 3 million Syrians back over the border. And that was not achievable while the Assad government were anywhere near. And this, I think, negotiations to manage this situation over the last year recently failed. That was the proximate cause of this breakout. But Erdogan realized he was getting nowhere by trying to negotiate a de facto partition with Assad. He would not tolerate the lingering presence of Turkish soldiers on Syrian soil. So instead, he's gone for the drastic solution, which has probably exceeded his expectations. And I think the question now really is whether Erdogan is not going to yank on the leash of these jihadis, stop them getting too far out of his control and reminding them what their job is, to be his border guard up in the north. They are, to help him, already branching out in the north. They're attacking the Kurds and beginning to trespass on areas where the Kurds are protected by American troops and where there are more ISIS prisons, by the way, and our own Shamima Begum is in one of these prisons, hoping, no doubt, that her jihadi friends might come and rescue her before very long.
Just looking at some of the latest news from the region, the Americans apparently offered to withdraw their troops from Syria earlier this week in exchange for Assad cutting ties with Iran, and so officials told the New York Times Israeli airstrikes and offers from the United States were part of a two-pronged approach to try and put pressure on Assad to cut his ties with Iran. He then refused, and we're now hearing that the US is framing the airstrikes in Syria as self-defense, despite happening amid the ongoing US-backed offensive. This week, the Kurdish SDF launched an offensive against a number of villages in eastern Syria. US has backed the offensive with military action. Al-Mayadeen even suggests that the offensive itself came at the behest of the US military. So there is a sort of sub-narrative to all of this, Peter, that it may simply be that Assad has refused this American request to cut ties with Iran, and this is their punishment.
Well, that's just ridiculous, and the New York Times, not for the first time, is just a mouthpiece for PSYOPs, The Syrian government has never needed the Iranians more than it needs them today. The idea that they would cut ties with Iran at this existential important moment in return for a vague American promise that they might leave Syria is ridiculous and must be seen for the psyop that it is.
I mean, surely there may be possibly some truth to it, that even though they knew that Assad was going to say no, the idea is it's a little bit like the mafia, isn't it? They smash up the windows of your shop and then they say, well, stop doing it if you do as we say.
Yes, well, the Americans may be coming to realize that they've created a rod for their own backs, because these jihadis are not far away now from some of those American bases in northern Syria, and they want, on behalf of Erdogan, to grab more land, which is nominally protected by the Americans. Only a few weeks ago, Turkish airplanes came very close to injuring U.S. soldiers in this area, which also hosts oil fields, which is why the Americans are there. Also, the Americans need to bear in mind that if push comes to shove, the balloon goes up and there's a wider conflagration, then those American troops are not assets, but liabilities. I wouldn't like to be the Pentagon general who had to explain why I'd lost 900 of my troops to Iranian attacks when I'd had warning that they were vulnerable. Anyway, maybe we only have to wait until January 20 for this all to start looking slightly different with the advent of the inauguration of the new American president, who in the past has shown a wish to withdraw those American forces because he's smarter than the other people around him.
Well, I love you, Peter, because you've just kind of pipped me to the post with my final question, which is, how do you think this new regime in the United States might alter the geopolitics down in the Middle East, particularly, obviously, with Gaza and Israel, with Amnesty's announcement this week? Most definitely genocide is taking place, and the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants for Netanyahu and his defense minister.
Well, I just say let's not assume that just because Trump is strong on pro-Israel rhetoric, and just because he's boasted of being the best American president Israel has ever had, and just because he's made some nominations of pro-Israeli nut jobs, putting one Mike Huckabee into the position of ambassador in Jerusalem, let's not assume that he's going to want to kiss Netanyahu's ring. I suspect that Donald is not a fool. Is playing to the Congress gallery here. And until he gets his nominations through Congress, which is far from a given, until he gets all his key nominations through, he's going to keep sounding very, very pro-Israeli. But what happens when he's a free man? When he's got his nominations through? When he no longer depends on the Israel lobby for votes and for money? There's nothing more dangerous than an American president who's not going to be up for re-election. So I think it may be, get interesting in the spring when we see the real Donald Trump. And Netanyahu may find that, unlike other American presidents, the Donald is not a doormat.
Peter, where can listeners find you and follow you on social media?
I'm afraid not. I value my sanity, so I don't tweet. I would advise people to check out the Workers' Party website, very simply, to keep abreast of what I'm saying in public statements. I made one about Syria. You can find it there. And no doubt there'll be more in the days ahead.
Well, I mean, we're all of us looking to interpret events as they unfold, particularly in Ukraine and the Middle East at the moment. Fascinating to see what's been going on in South Korea, too. I had to laugh at that. So could you please just give us a tip as to maybe one or two news outlets that are not the mainstream press here, where we can get a little bit of a bit more of a critical analysis of this?
Yes, well, I'm no better informed about Korea than the average TV watcher. But of course, there's a pattern here, and the president who himself has gone off the reservation by declaring martial law is, of course, very pro-American, very anti-North Korea, unable to accept any dissent, anything less than 190% opposition to North Korea. Well, it seems to have backfired on him and the Americans, and it's made the North Koreans look rather moderate, which is amazing.
So even just one news website that you could come close to recommending?
Well, just recently I've been following Rybar, R-Y-B-A-R, which is basically a Russian think tank. They appear to be very well informed about Syria, and they appear to be very realistic as well.
Okay, Peter Ford, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tony. A pleasure.